Our next guest has been a writer for more than a quarter of a century on social, personal and psychological issues such as forgiveness, relationships and happiness. New Zealand-born Stephanie Dowrick has had 5 international bestsellers. She left this country as a young woman to go travelling and found herself in London, where in 1978 she co-founded the feminist publisher The Women's Press. Well, Stephanie Dowrick then began writing, at first fiction, but increasingly non-fiction books. Some would call them self-help or personal growth books. She struggles with both labels. She also became a trained psychotherapist and an ordained interfaith minister. It's the issue of faith and religion that she's turned to in her latest book, just released, called Seeking the Sacred. And Stephanie Dowrick is with us now on the line from Sydney. Nice to talk to you.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. The title itself, enough to scare many away. What are you seeking to highlight in your new book?
Oh, I see the title as an invitation, not as scaring people away. On the contrary, because I think that most people, I would even emphasize most people have some sense of the sacred and some sense of their need for the sacred. I mean, even at this very moment in New Zealand where the community is facing a great potential sorrow or crisis and really feeling the anxiety of other people, many people will understand that this empathy that they're feeling or this concern that they're feeling, they may not call it sacred, but it arises out of a sense of connection with one another that is, I think, intrinsically sacred. So I'm not sure that the word sacred is scary for everybody.
What do we mean by it, though?
Well, I give quite a lot of different possibilities of what we may mean by it, because I don't want to be too reductive in thinking about it. But basically, it's a sense that life has more to offer us and means more to us than simply putting food into our mouths and going to sleep at night. Those things are very, very important. All the sort of the physical manifestations of life are very, very important. But we also live in a realm of feeling and of imagination and of experience. And we also have very strong urges as a human species to create meaning and to make meaning out of things. And by meaning, I don't just mean why something happens, but how should we understand it, and what should our response be, and what can our response be?
So these
all take us into the realm of what we might call the sacred or the transcendent or the non-measurable of life.
Some might say that that is part of the human condition.
Absolutely.
That we have been blessed or cursed with a higher order brain that seeks far more meaning, and that searches for answers beyond the physical realm. Does this mean that you have, or that one must have, the belief in a higher power or the belief in a god or gods? Or is it a reflection of our intelligence and the questions that we can't answer?
It's all that and much more. One of the joys of writing this book, Seeking the Sacred, has been that I've been able to use my really long, deep knowledge of the different world faiths to show that there are real cultural differences in how religious thinking and seeking the sacred has manifested for different people at different times. But there are also essential similarities that what people seek, the kind of comfort they seek, the kind of illumination they seek, the kind of inspiration they seek is remarkably similar. You know, I think at one point in the book I say no matter, you know, how we stand to meditate or pray or contemplate or chant or sing or just simply talk about these questions, we're looking in the same direction. And I think that that's really important, because one of the things that I'm trying to do in this book is to say, let's celebrate our differences. Let's not be frightened of them, but let's also acknowledge, because this is an urgent thing to acknowledge in this time, that we are in fact a single human family, and that we, in the 21st century, perhaps understand this better and more urgently than we ever have before. Whether or not people need to have a personal relationship with a transcendent being that they call God is not entirely, what would I even say? Look, clearly Buddhism, for example, The Buddha himself said that God was one of the unanswerable questions. In no way did he deny God or the existence of a transcendent being that we might call God, but he was also not going to limit God or put God in a box. So people seeking of the sacred may be divinely inspired in their view and lead to a very personal relationship, or it may not. But what really matters, I guess, is how we view life, how we view ourselves, and of course, how we view one another, because that will determine our actions.
When we talk about organized religion, obviously spirituality, which is within the realm of what you're talking about here, and seeking the sacred, can be found and expressed in many ways for many people. Right. It is for our Maori people, for example, it might be not only in a belief in their gods, but a very physical connection with land and with sea. For many of us in this part of the world, that is what we regard as our spirituality. Yep. What is the role of organized religion in your view, then?
Oh, well, The many roles of the organized religions have been complex. We know that they're part of our human story. And you know, one of the things that I've been really able to explore and show, I think, quite successfully in this book, because I tell a lot of different stories that I've gathered from people in all sorts of circumstances. One of the things that it shows is that all the religions, but in different sorts of ways, have fostered the fundamental ethic of this book, which is that we could live much less violently and much more respectfully and compassionately alongside one another, and that our need to do this is actually really very urgent. And on the other hand, each of the religions, again in their own way, also has a very long institutional and ideological shadow. So we know that as institutions, as human institutions, the religions are capable of, the highest forms of human behavior and the very worst.
And the very worst is often what people point to. They often point to a lot of the worst human tragedies and wars throughout history have been under the umbrella of organized religion.
And continuing now. And I say very clearly in this book that when a religion or when individuals in the name of a religion perpetuate the myth that they can justify violence, it ceases to be religious in my view. I mean, I'm really very, very clear about that. And equally, I say that when someone says, I'm following a spiritual path, or, I'm a very spiritual person, when someone says that, but it's actually entirely self-focused, I would also take that with some skepticism. That I think a genuine spiritual, or even when spiritual comes together with the psychological and social and produces a kind of awakening in us, a realization of what we're capable of being, it always involves a sense of responsibility for the kind of society that we're collectively creating, for how we affect other people in our workplace. That's why in this book particularly, I mean, I paid attention to these qualities in other books, but maybe particularly in forgiveness and other acts of love. But in this book, I'm being really, really strong about this whole notion that we need to take responsibility for how we're affecting other people. And interestingly enough, all the research around happiness shows that our happiness also, our personal happiness, in fact, depends upon this. So we have a lot of psychological references. I spare the reader, but we have a lot of psychological research also to show that our maturity as well as our happiness will depend on this realization that I am affecting other people and that I need not be only obsessed with how other people are affecting me.
And non-believers would say, well, actually, under our approach to life, we can be just as respectful of those things without needing a religious or a spiritual dimension. I wanted to ask about atheism, actually, and the rise of many of those writing, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, the leaders among them.
Yes.
In its own way, atheism has become almost as zealous a practice as some of the religions. How do you explain that?
Yes, Catherine, I think it is one of the very fascinating, and it was a rather unpredictable feature of 21st century life, isn't it, that religion has come to be somewhat in the forefront of all sorts of debates. I mean, certainly that wasn't true in the 80s or 90s or even leading up to the century. So I think it's very, very interesting. But it's also been quite polarizing. And one of the catalysts, really, for my writing this book was that I could see quite clearly that the debate was being dominated by the voices at one end of the religious fundamentalists of different kinds, not just Christian religious fundamentalists, and not just Muslim either, and people who were completely certain that their way was the way, and who defined themselves often in relation to other people's incorrect views. And then at the other end were the somewhat zealous new atheists, who weren't really all that new, but who were also rather zealous in telling people that, you know, if they were searching or seeking for the sacred or living a life in which there was a realization of the sacred, that this was really rather foolish and regressive. So I felt that there were, and I actually knew from my own experience of working with lots of people, lots of groups, in all kinds of ways, that there were many people in a huge arc of opinion between those rather strident positions who, in their quiet ways, and sometimes not so quiet ways, really were saying, let me stand up for something that isn't just the measurable, isn't just the material, that I may or may not give a name to, or that I may be experiencing my religious faith in quite a different way, or I may be making my spiritual journey in quite a different way. So I guess I felt that this book would affirm that, affirm the legitimacy of that.
The tolerance that you talk about, the interfaith tolerance, has been a quite dramatic phenomenon of recent times, actually, between not only the major churches,
yes,
within Christendom, say, but between the faiths, even between the Christian faiths and the Muslim faiths. Tolerance of others' beliefs is one thing, but you know that within those major faiths there is also the fundamental argument that our way is the way. And what do you say to those who say, well, you're wishy-washy if you say pick whatever route you want?
Well, you know, I do hear that, Catherine. I hear it a lot. And I have to say that, for example, if we were really to follow the primary teachings of all the theistic faiths, let's just look at those for a moment, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, we would see that at the very heart of them is what is called the golden rule, which is basically that we have no right to harm another person, that we need to treat other people as we wish to be treated. So I would say that far from being wishy-washy, I would say that I am really inviting people to consider whether they have the courage and the backbone to go to the heart of the matter, which is to refuse to do harm to another person, even if you disagree with their views. So I think that actually what I'm arguing for is very, very far from wishy-washy and takes quite a lot of strength of mind. It's very much easier to be cynical. It's very much easier to be judgmental. It's sometimes very much easier to be violent and to justify violence. So I'm standing up with a whole lot of other really grand voices, you know, Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King and Paul the epistle writer and so on and so on. And I'm saying versions of do everything in such a way that the sacred can be revealed through it.
I'm speaking
or that respect for other human beings can be revealed through it. I mean, even in Islam, there's a hadith which says, do you love your creator? Then love your neighbor more. Because I think he knew that it's much harder sometimes to love our very annoying neighbour than to love the creator.
I'm speaking with Stephanie Dowrick. She is, among many things, a psychotherapist, an ordained interfaith minister, and also co-founder of the feminist publisher The Women's Press. Her new book is called Seeking the Sacred. It's 13 minutes away from 11 on 9 to noon. Indeed, Stephanie, your path has been a fascinating one. You left New Zealand at 20, a self-described unhappy girl. And I'm wondering, apart from the things that make most of us unhappy at 20, what was the situation as you left these shores?
I don't describe myself as an unhappy person, but I certainly felt, oh no, I would never describe myself as an unhappy person. Because I had a lot of energy and a lot of courage, I think, leaving at that age. New Zealand was a country where I lost my mother as a little girl. And so for me, you know, that was very colouring of my early experiences. It was also a country in which I moved as a child from being a Protestant to being a Catholic, which actually, of course, has allowed me to write some very, I think, even quite funny parts of the book. There's lots of storytelling in this book. It's not at all a solemn read. But also I was a very adventurous person, and I think a very optimistic person, in the sense that I really felt that there were things that I needed to discover. And for me, at that time, I needed to go and I needed to live in a different place. And actually, I arrived in Britain at a time that was an enormously exciting time, particularly for women. And you know, the whole civil rights movement was really taking off. The women's movement was taking off. The peace movement was taking off. You know, and it was an incredible privilege to be a part of that. And it was an incredible part of my education also.
You first embraced feminism. You founded the women's press.
I did.
And what was the basis of your views at that time then, in the 70s, that this was really where a lot of that energy was being poured?
Yes. Well, in the 70s and into the 80s, of course, it was an extraordinary time, because we were saying that we need to look at a whole lot of really fundamental social questions from a different point of view. We can't just accept the analysis that has been given to us. We really need to reanalyze a whole lot of assumptions. I mean, it was assumed, for example, when I was a girl growing up, that Catholics and Protestants couldn't get on. It was assumed when I was growing up that women would be happy to be a nurse or a teacher until they got married and had three children. I mean, there were a lot of assumptions that would almost seem laughable now. And, you know, those assumptions had to be interrogated. I mean, in the same way, funnily enough, or not, perhaps not so funnily, in the same way in this new book, Seeking the Sacred, which very much comes in a trajectory with my earlier writings, I'm saying we need to question the assumption that violence is a reasonable response to social problems. Well, I think we really need to question this, or that we can just use up the earth without giving something back to it. So I guess that in the social questioning of the 70s and 80s, I was also personally preparing myself to ask the kinds of questions that I'm asking now. But I guess what has shifted is that I'm asking them as part of the human family, whereas in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, I was very much saying that there are urgent questions that we must ask as women. But I also haven't given that up. For example, I'm still active within the International Women's Development Agency, which is the only non-government agency in the Pacific region that looks at issues where women are particularly vulnerable, where women and children are particularly vulnerable. There are still issues where that prevails.
Well, was there a conflict, I'm wondering, Stephanie, at the time, because of the patriarchy of the churches in which you had grown up, and indeed that which you moved to? One would have sensed a real conflict between the feminism you were exploring and your spiritual journey. Did they conflict for a time?
No, they don't conflict, in the sense that I think it's an essential part of it to say that where any religion is being patriarchal in its attitudes, where any religion is being imperialist in its attitudes, you know, which they're all pretty good at, it's up to all of us, women and men alike, to say this is totally unacceptable. You know, this moves us very far away from the heart of religion, which is, as I said earlier, really to bring us into a much more tolerant connection with one another and with the physical world in which we live, and perhaps with the spiritual world. But primarily, it has to be about conduct. It has to be about how we see one another and what we believe we are and what we believe we're capable of being. So I think far from being in conflict, I think it's very illuminating, it's very inspiring and reinforcing even, that we can actually afford to be generous, that we do not have to be imperialist in our attitudes wherever we're coming from. And actually that at this time we cannot afford to be. I mean, we simply cannot afford to be, because that is the basis of conflict.
You have written also a great deal about happiness.
I have.
Would it be summed up as the acceptance of what one has rather than what one doesn't have?
Well, certainly an appreciation of what one has, and particularly in regard to our relationships with one another. I don't just mean our intimate family relationships, but, for example, in this very difficult moment that New Zealand is facing as a community now, everything will depend for the people who are directly concerned on the quality of support that they get from one another. You know, our well-being, we can't just call it our happiness. Our emotional well-being absolutely depends on us developing our capacities to be supportive of one another, and not just in times of crisis either. Also, in more what we might call more normal times, how we treat one another, the respect that we give one another, even when we dislike one another's views, or just those little acts of generosity and kindness. I often take, you know, the queue at the bank or the queue at the supermarket as an example, or how we treat one another in traffic. All those many, many moments make up a life, and they make a huge difference. You know, the kindness of a nurse to someone who's waiting for a medical test. You know, we often have jobs that we consider to be quite humble and not influential, and yet in the course of a day, we influence so many people, and how we influence them will depend in an absolute way on who we think we are and what we think we're capable of being, and whether we think we're capable of being a kind of you know, passing along the baton of kindness or of bitterness.
And how does one reach that point? I know that one of your many strands has been your training as a psychotherapist,
yeah,
where most roads anyway tend to lead back to childhood. How do people get to this point of knowing themselves and being comfortable with themselves in the way that you describe?
I think very, very easily, Catherine. Very, very easily. Simply by noticing what affects them positively. Simply by noticing what they'd like more of and doing it. I mean, you don't have to have a lifelong analysis to really see that the behavior of some people deeply hurts you or offends you or makes you feel very anxious. Or to notice that when you are affecting other people positively or negatively, you don't have to do more than notice. Be aware, be awake, as the Buddhists would say. Wake up to what is really working in your life and what is not. Be strengthened by doing more of what is working well. And I give in the books, in Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love, in Seeking the Sacred, in Choosing Happiness, I give so many examples of very ordinary people, so-called, really living this out and learning from their own mistakes and not being overwhelmed when you have done the wrong thing again, but noticing it in such a way that you can learn from it rather than wallowing in, you know, some version of guilt or self-pity, really thinking, you know, I don't actually have to do that again. I don't have to speak to that person in that harsh way again. I can move on. You know, this is such a strengthening thing to know and to notice, and that I have already got the qualities that I need. It's just really a matter of letting them loose.
A key part of what your message seems to be, which is a lot of tolerance, happiness, or at least...
Generosity
and acceptance of what one has, would include one key component that many people struggle with, and you've written a whole book about it, and that is forgiveness.
Yes.
And the ability to forgive. A relatively small word for what can be a very difficult act, even if one's intent is to forgive.
Yes.
What have you learned about the art of it?
Oh, I've learned so much. I've learned that where someone is unable to move towards a place of forgiveness, not necessarily achieve the whole thing, and certainly not say that whatever it was that has disturbed them or wounded them or hurt them doesn't matter, certainly not that, but that the person is able at least to say, I will no longer wish you harm. And that is a theme that I take up very much in this book, Seeking the Sacred, also. When we cease to wish someone else harm, when we wish to pray even that they might suffer, or to be obsessed with a desire that they would suffer, then we free ourselves. When we are hooked into an event or a series of events that has limited our lives or destroyed something within us, we remain in the past. And it also means that we are not then available to appreciate what is happening for us right now in this moment, even to appreciate the kindness of people that we may so desperately need. So the forgiveness, the multiple acts that add up to forgiveness and that may take some time, really start with this determination that wherever I'm going in my life, I'm going to unhook myself from this desire to cause someone else the same pain that I have felt. This is really, really very, very important. And of course, what it adds up to also is a feeling that I do not need to retaliate. I can move myself into a different emotional space. I think that this is very, very liberating. It also allows a person to step into their own sense of maturity, that they can feel more empowered. Often when someone has experienced something that is very, very painful, they feel as if all the power about how their life will be lived has been stripped away. They need to reclaim some of their power. And I give many examples of how to do this.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's been lovely talking to you. Stephanie Dowrick. She is, as we said, an interfaith minister, ordained interfaith minister. She's a trained psychotherapist and was a real pioneer with the feminist publisher The Women's Press. Her latest book, Seeking the Sacred.